Okay, so I'm going to mute everyone, and we're going to begin. So today we're going to speak about the Israel's law of return. In Hebrew, it's called the Chok HaShvut. Hold on, I just have to mute everyone. Okay, in Israel, it's called the Chok HaShvut. It's called in Hebrew, it's called the Chok HaShvut, and basically under this law, any Jew in the world has the right to become a citizen of Israel. So what we're going to do today is we're going to first discuss the history of this law, a few famous court cases that were adjudicated relating to this law. And then I think we're going to address the two most challenging issues regarding this law. Number one, how does this law stand up to claims of discrimination? Israel is a Jewish and democratic state, and these terms may seem to be contradictory. How is it democratic for a state to provide citizenship for a certain group and not another group? So that's one issue we're going to discuss. And I think actually we can provide a coherent answer to this first question. The second issue is actually a more difficult issue, which is who is a Jew? How do we determine Jewishness in the state of Israel? Is the current definition appropriate or should it be changed? I find that to be a more difficult question to answer. So again, let's begin with the history. But before we do that, I think we need to ask a basic question, which is what's the rationale for this law? Now, is it so that a Jew everywhere can find a home where he or she can escape anti-Semitism? Or does the law reflect the fact that irrespective of anti-Semitism, the Jewish homeland in Israel is based on the promise by God, or maybe based on our history, and therefore every Jew should have the right to live there, even if there was not an issue of anti-Semitism. And I think that these two rationales are not necessarily mutually exclusive, but I think we should keep both goals in mind as we go through the history and the issues that come up relating to this law. So in 1917, the Balfour Declaration was issued, and there was also a mandate of the League of Nations in 1924. And both of these documents provided explicit international recognition of the Jews' right to return, but they did not do anything to secure or implement this principle. The newly established Israeli government implemented the right of return by passing the Chok HaShvut, or the Law of Return. The law essentially grants all Jews the right to immigrate to and settle in Israel. The only, if you look here, and I guess the first source, letter A, the Law of Return, so this was passed in 1950. And if you see that in 2A, every Jew has a right to come as an Ole, an Aliyah shall be by Ole's visa. And in 2B, an Ole's visa shall be granted to every Jew who has expressed his desire to settle in Israel, unless the Minister of Immigration is satisfied that the applicant is engaged in an activity directed against the Jewish people or is likely to endanger public health or the security of the state. So again, basically, the only exception to this privilege exists in cases where the state viewed an individual as a danger to the health and security of the state or as a threat to national peace. Now, in 1952, there was this nationality law which was passed, which provides that anyone who obtains an Ole certificate may then become a citizen. So there's step one is the law of return. Every Jew can be an Ole. And the nationality law says that basically, if you're an Ole, you can automatically become a citizen. In 1955, there was an amendment. In 1955, they added another exception to who cannot be automatically granted citizenship. And that is, if you look in letter B, Law of Return, 1955, they added in number was of one, I guess two under one, says you should add the following paragraph: if a person has a criminal past and is likely to endanger public welfare. So dangerous criminals could also be denied that right. And probably the most notable rejection based on this amendment was in September of 1972, when Meyer Lansky, he was 70 years old at the time. He was a dominant figure in a powerful American crime group that sometimes operated in concert with the mafia. And he filed suit after the Israeli government refused to extend his visitor's visa. He and his wife Thelma had been living in Israel as tourists since July of 1970. The Israeli Supreme Court ruled that he was not entitled to Israeli citizenship, but it would offer him, you see here, this is a New York Times article, they would offer him special travel papers. In other words, they offer him a travel document to let him go to any country that would take him. Okay, so that was, that was a fascinating, application of this rule of rejecting someone automatically because he is considered a public danger. Now, I want to turn to two court cases which are important for different reasons. The first, because it's an example where the definition of who is a Jew was actually more restrictive for the Israeli Supreme Court justice for the Supreme Court than halacha. And the second, because it resulted in a further amendment of the law of return. So the first court case, again, we're going to see is that the Israeli Supreme Court or the Israeli Supreme Court, or the Israeli law, turns out to be more machmir in the definition of a Jew than halacha. So what's the case? So this is the case called the Brother Daniel case, officially known as Rufeisen versus Minister of the Interior. So we have here, letter D, this is a man, name is Oswald Rufeisen. So Shmuel Oswald Rufeisen was a Jew born near a town which I cannot pronounce, but it's a town that later became Auschwitz in 1922. During his youth, Shmuel Oswald Rufeisen belonged to Bnei Akiva. In 1941, he helped save hundreds of fellow Jews in the Belarusian town of Mir, another famous town which you're familiar with, from deportation to concentration camps, and he saved them by infiltrating the local police station as a translator under the assumed identity as an ethnically German Pole. He then joined the partisans, and while in hiding, he hid in a convent, and while he was in this convent, he converted to Christianity, and he was baptized. Now, after the war, he became a friar, and eventually he became a Catholic priest. In the 1950s, under pressure from a wave of anti-Semitism from the Polish government, he applied for Israeli citizenship under the law of return, and he maintained that even though his religion was Catholicism, he was still a Jew. And he said, quote, "My ethnic origin is and always will be Jewish. I have no other nationality. If I am not a Jew, what am I? I did not accept Christianity to leave my people. I added it to my Judaism. I feel as a Jew." Of course, that's fascinating because we obviously view our Judaism, I think, most of us, maybe all of us, we view our Judaism as not only our religion, but also our nationality, our ethnicity. And he views himself as a Christian from a religious standpoint, but ethnically he views himself as a Jew. Now, the halacha, how would halacha view Shmuel Oswald Rufeisen? So the halacha is pretty clear. Halacha is, Yisrael afa bi shechata Yisrael hu, a Jew who sins, even though he sins, he's still considered a Jew. And in fact, it's not to say that someone who converts to Christianity, we treat him like a non-Jew with respect to certain halachos, but fundamentally he still is a Jew. And in fact, this is codified in Shulchan Aruch, Evan Ezer, Simon Mem Dal, Tzif Tes, Yisrael Mumar Shekidesh, Kidushav Kidushin, Gemur Mitzricha Yimena Get. Let's say a Jew who converts to Catholicism, so he marries a Jewish woman, so, and then she wants to marry someone else. So if a non-Jewish man marries a Jewish woman, and the Jewish woman wants to marry another man, she does not need a get from the first man. The first man's not Jewish. There is no halachic institution of marriage. I don't know whether, what the halach would say, it's appropriate to get a civil divorce, probably. But I'm just saying from a halachic standpoint, if a non-Jew marries a Jew, so there's no halachic, the halacha does not recognize their institution of marriage. But if a Jew who's a mumar, who converts to Christianity, to any religion, who basically denies basic Jewish principles of faith, and who converts to Christianity, that he is mekadesh a woman, and he would require a get. So in other words, halacha would still view Shmuel Oswald Raphaizen, the priest, as a Jew. That being said, the Israeli Supreme Court justice, the Israeli Supreme Court, by a 4-1 decision, ruled that a Roman Catholic could not simultaneously be a Jew as defined by the law of return. Even though according to halacha, he might still be considered a Jew, the term Jew should be according to secular principles, because the law of return was secular legislation. So the court found that one who had converted to another religion was no longer a Jew. And one justice, Justice Silberg, wrote, quote, "To grant application for citizenship under the law of return would obliterate the historical meaning of the term Jew and deny all the spiritual values for which Jews had been persecuted and killed during various periods of the long exile." In other words, he felt that granting this petition meant sacrificing the historical continuity of a religion that had never been conceived as being a partner with any other religion. Nevertheless, what's the end of the story? The end of the story is Raphaizen went to the Stella Maris Carmelite Monastery in Haifa as a Carmelite friar. He acquired Israeli citizenship like any other non-citizen desiring citizenship, and he lived the rest of his life at the monastery. And in other words, what's important to understand is it's true a Jew has the automatic right to citizenship based on law of return, but someone who's not a Jew can still apply for citizenship, and just like someone who's not an American can apply for citizenship in America, and there are certain rules and regulations. What we're talking about here is the law of return, which provides an automatic right, and Shmuel Oswald Raphaizen was not deemed to be under the rule of a Jew, the definition of a Jew, based on the Supreme Court. So that's the first fascinating, one more fascinating cases of the law of return. So let's turn now to the 1969 Israeli Supreme Court case of Shalit versus Minister of the Interior. In 1960, out of deference to the halachic position, the Minister of the Interior declared that only a person born of a Jewish mother could be registered as a Jew on one's identity card. Now, the Benjamin Shalit, who was an Israeli Jew, he married a Scottish woman with no religious affiliation. In 1960, the two moved from Scotland to Haifa, and they subsequently had two children. And Shalit attempted to register the children as having Jewish nationality with no formal religion. However, the ministry did not allow Shalit's children to have Israeli nationality on their identity cards. Shalit petitioned the Supreme Court for an order directing the Minister of the Interior to show cause why the children should not be registered as Jews in regard to nationality. Again, he's saying, okay, we are atheists from a religious standpoint, but we still view ourselves Jews from a nationalistic standpoint. The government argued that you're only a Jew if your mother is Jewish or if you have a formal religious conversion, and this rule has been used as a guide against assimilation. As I mentioned, the Shalits were atheists, so they refused to have their children participate in a conversion ceremony. The court ruled that Benjamin Shalit and his children could be registered as Jews. Why was this different in the Brother Daniel case? Because Shalit did not take any actions to disassociate themselves from the Jewish people. Brother Daniel was a Jew, and he specifically took steps to remove himself from Judaism, but the Shalits did not. So the religious parties were not happy about this. They wanted the government to more precisely define who is a Jew and not leave it to the courts. And so in 1970, the government amended the law. I have a Jerusalem Post article. This is from 1970. Who is a Jew? Amendment becomes law. So let's see what is this new amendment. This is the second amendment to the law of return. So it says here, this letter G, so it says the rights of a Jew under this law and the rights of an Oleh under the nationality law, as well as the rights of an Oleh under any enactment, are also vested in a child or grandchild of a Jew, the spouse of a Jew, the spouse of a child of a Jew, and the spouse of a grandchild of a Jew, except someone who has voluntarily changed his religion, like Brother Daniel. And it shall be immaterial whether or not a Jew, whether this Jew is still alive, and whether he has not immigrated to Israel. So essentially, this actually, in other words, maybe, oh, I'm sorry, and then, one second, there should be something about, right, so then the 4b, for the purposes of this law, Jew means a person who was born of a Jewish mother or who has become converted to Judaism and who is not a member of another religion. So what's fascinating about this amendment is that it defines a Jew as maybe someone who is halachically Jewish, maybe, because it says you have to be born of a Jewish mother. But it, of course, when it says someone who's been converted to Judaism, it doesn't say what type of conversion. But it does have the definition as being born of a Jewish mother. But then who has the rights of Aliyah? So that's very broad now. Because you get automatic citizenship can be granted to non-Jewish children and grandchildren and spouses and to non-Jewish spouses of children and grandchildren. And why was this amended? It's so that families are not broken apart. And there will be a safe haven for non-Jews subject to persecution because of Jewish roots. And what's even more fascinating is that a Jewish relative doesn't have to be alive anymore. So anyone who has a Jewish ancestry, if someone, they themselves may not be Jewish, but if they have a Jewish father or grandfather, they can be granted automatic citizenship. And again, as I mentioned, it doesn't define what does it mean, converted. The law has, by the way, the law has no special constitutional status. What that means is that all you need is a simple Knesset majority and you can overturn the law. In other words, if something is like a constitutional right, so then you need a lot more to overturn that law. But this is not in the Constitution, the basic law of Israel, and therefore, if you have 61 MKs, and you have the right, you know, they want to make deals with the government, so they perhaps can change the law. Now, there have been attempts by the Ministry of the Interior, especially when it was run by the Haredi parties, to not register non-Orthodox conversions as Jews. The rule hasn't applied. Can they change this ex post facto? Can they rescind someone's citizenship? I don't know the answer to that question. I don't think so, but I don't know for certain. Okay. And the pedophiles, so that could be under, you know, people who present a public danger. So I'm not sure if it's limited to pedophiles. But in any case, in 1988, so again, there have been attempts by the Haredim to change, to amend this law to say only converted by Orthodox conversions. In 1988 specifically, the Haredi parties attempted to have the law changed to limit converts who were converted Orthodox in exchange for joining either Likud or Labor. Like sometimes we think about, you know, different deals that different parties are making, and we think that sometimes, let's say the Haredi parties, they might be negotiating about, you know, how much money you're going to give to yeshivos or issues about, you know, Israelis, Haredim serving the IDF. So this could also be an issue that could be debated in a future deal when there's an election in Israel. So in 1988, the proposal never went anywhere because of the outrage in the non-Orthodox Jewish community. So this 1970 amendment, which you can see a lot of people may not be happy with, it still has stood sort of the test of time all the way 50 years, even until today. So I want to discuss now two issues to consider when evaluating this law. So the first is the issue of is the law of return not a, I don't think, no, I don't think it's a, it's not, this is not, this is not a basic law. This was a law that was passed in 1950, as far as I know. But it can't, this law can be amended by a simple majority. Now, the first issue I want to discuss is discrimination. So one criticism of the law of return is that it is discriminatory against non-Jews. How can Israel call itself a Jewish and democratic state, with democratic meaning treating everyone equal while allowing automatic citizenship to one group and not another? That seems to be very undemocratic. Some Arab critics who demand a right of return for Palestinian refugees have charged that Israel simply wants to bring more immigrants to counterbalance Palestinian demographics. How do we respond to claims of discrimination? So I want to read to you a passage by Ruth Gavison. She was a she actually just passed away. She was the professor of law at Hebrew University. She is a tremendous scholar. I think she just passed away this past year. And this is something about, in general, the idea of how can you have a Jewish state, a state that perhaps has certain rules that favor Jews while still being a democratic state. So we're going to read this and then we'll try to discuss it a bit. I'll explain it a bit. So one commonly held view of liberal democracy asserts that the state must be absolutely neutral with regard to the cultural, ethnic, and religious identity of its population and of its public sphere. I do not share this view. I believe that such total neutrality is impossible, and that in the context of the region, it is not desired by any group. The character of Israel as a Jewish nation does generate some tension with the democratic principle of civic equality. Nonetheless, this tension does not prevent Israel from being a democracy. There is no inherent disagreement between the Jewish identity of the state and its liberal, democratic nature. The state I will describe would have a stable and large Jewish majority. It would respect the rights of all of its citizens, irrespective of nationality and religion, and would recognize the distinct interests and cultures of its various communities. It would not, however, abandon its preference for the interests of a particular national community, nor would it need to. The Jewish state, whose existence I will justify, is not therefore a neutral state of all its citizens. Israel has basic obligations to democracy and human rights, but its language is Hebrew. Its weekly daily of rest is Saturday, and it marks Jewish religious festivals as public holidays. The public culture of the state is Jewish, although it is not a theocracy, nor does it impose a specific religious concept of Jewish identity on its citizens. Essentially, this sort of my take on this is that the main argument in favor of the principle of return, of the law of return, is based on the principle of self-determination. This principle recognizes the right to self-determination of groups and even the notion of a nation state, a state in which the ethnic majority group realizes its right to self-determination. Israel was created as a Jewish state, and this was approved by the UN decisions, and therefore the state of Israel became a place in which the Jewish people realizes its right to self-determination. The reason for the state of Israel was to concentrate Jews in one location so that they would constitute a large portion or even the majority in that place, and as a result, enable Jews to live a complete Jewish existence in a place where they did not depend upon the goodwill of other peoples. Only a Jewish state would grant Jews the security for full expression of their Jewishness without fear of harm or pressures to assimilate. The law of return stems from this right of self-determination to ensure that every Jew has a right and has a place where he or she can fully express a Jewish life and to ensure that Israel maintain its Jewish majority. And Ruth Gavison wrote an article specifically about the law of return. And in that article, she asserted that immigration laws which favor immigrants sharing the ethnicity of the country of destination are found in different forms in Europe, in countries such as Germany, Finland, Greece, Poland, Hungary, Bulgaria, Slovakia, the Czech Republic, Slovenia, Turkey, and Croatia. I did not research the specifics, but that's what she asserts. Other manifestations of an ethnic majority group realizing its right to self-determination in a state include, let's say, a flag, a national anthem, the language as being the Hebrew, and the calendar. However, a country can be a nation state with special preferences for its ethnicity and still be a democracy as long as it provides basic rights for all of its citizens, such as the right to vote, the right to freedom of speech and religion, and the right to physical safety. In other words, the character of the state is Jewish, and therefore there will be certain laws that help shape the character, like the law of return, but it is democratic as it protects the basic rights of every citizen. In other words, this argument would say to be a democratic country does not necessarily mean that everyone is treated equal. You could have a special character related to a state that favors a certain ethnic group, but at the same time, as long as basic rights are provided, then that does not invalidate this the state from being both a Jewish and a democratic state. And I personally find that argument compelling. Again, this is not a religious or a halachic argument. This is a Ruth Gavison is not a she was not a religious and orthodox person, and this was simply a political argument. Now, the other issue, I think, which is actually more complicated, which may seem simpler from a halachic standpoint, but is actually more complicated, which is who is a Jew for purposes of this law, and what do we feel about that? What should Orthodox Jews feel about that? Should the law of return be amended? On the one hand, it was formulated in the shadow of the Holocaust, when the Nazis did not discriminate between someone whose mother was Jewish and someone whose father was Jewish. So maybe the rule should be, whomever Nazis called a Jew and was sent to the death camps should be offered refuge in the newly established state of Israel. At the time when the law of return was created, it seemed inconceivable that anyone but a Jew would claim to be a Jew. I remember when I once gave a shiur on the question of, let's say someone comes to shul one day and says, I'm a Jew, I would like an aliyah. Okay, so besides the question of who gets aliyahs in shul, can we trust someone who says that he or she is Jewish, that he or she is Jewish, just because someone says it? And Rav Moshe Feinstein has a line where he'd say that, nobody would say they're Jewish if they're not Jewish. So again, when Rav Moshe Feinstein made that comment, that might have been true. Question, is that true now? And certainly, in the shadow of the Holocaust, you can imagine that there wouldn't be anyone or very few people who would want to assert that they're Jewish if they're not Jewish. That being said, since the founding of the State of Israel, people have immigrated to Israel for many different reasons: a sense of belonging, strengthening Jewish identity, religious imperatives, joining family members already in Israel, fleeing tyranny, economic hardship, anti-Semitism, and a combination of those and other rationales. And the question is, do we continue with the existing definition of a Jew as currently exists, or who can get automatic citizenship, or do we amend it to exclude conversions by conservative reform movement? Do we continue allowing non-Jewish relatives to have the privileges of the law of return? And if we take the view that halacha is not the line, what should be the line? In 1989, the Supreme Court of Israel ruled that Messianic Judaism, i.e. Jews for Jesus, they were not eligible for Aliyah under the law. In 2008, Jews for Jesus applicants argued that the law which said that if you convert like Brother Daniel, that doesn't apply to them. Why? Because Brother Daniel originally was Jewish and then he converted to Christianity. But a Messianic Jew, a Jews for Jesus, they had never been Jews according to Halacha and were not, and therefore they were not excluded by the conversion clause. And some of them had Jewish ancestry. In other words, you had these people, these Messianic, these Jews for Jesus, who were never, let's say, non-Jews for Jesus, but converted. They were always Jews for Jesus, but they claimed Jewish ancestry. They said they had a Jewish grandfather, a Jewish father, and they said, we want to be granted automatic citizenship. And the court agreed with their argument. In 2011, a same-sex couple made Aliyah, one Jewish and one Catholic. The Jewish man automatically received citizenship. And the question was, can the non-Jewish spouse be granted automatic citizenship under the law of return? And he was granted citizenship by the Ministry of the Interior. But I'd like you to consider the following. Israeli newspapers reported at the end of December of 1994 that the churches in Nazareth were full to overflowing due to the large influx of Olim from the former Soviet Union, many of whom were believing and practicing Christians. Some estimates say that anywhere from 8 to 30% of immigrants from the former Soviet Union are non-Jews. There was a report that in 1950, a Jew from Kurdistan emigrated to Israel together with his three sons, but left behind a pregnant wife. So this woman, this Jewish woman who left behind in Kurdistan, subsequently married a Muslim neighbor and gave birth to a daughter. The daughter, being born of a Jewish mother, later emigrated to Israel. The mother remained behind with her Muslim husband, to whom she bore nine sons, all of whom were given Muslims' names, such as Ahmed, Mahmoud, Ali, and Othman, and they were raised in the Muslim faith. All nine sons, Baruch Hashem, married, with all fine families, and several wives each. The Jewish sons who had emigrated to Israel at some point sought out their mother, who was living in Kurdistan, and they requested that she and her entire family be allowed to come to Israel. Indeed, under the law of return, because the mother was Jewish, she was able to bring her 170 children, grandchildren, and their spouses, named Mahmoud, Ali, Ahmed, etc., etc., etc. Now, besides the Russian Aliyah, which included many non-Jews, at times, Jews have arrived from somewhere and claim that they are part of the 10 lost tribes. Close to 100 people called Bene Israel arrived from a province in India, claiming to be from the tribe of Menashe. Other would-be Jews arrived from Peru. I have here from an Israel Hayom article just a year ago. This was the Israeli Supreme Court ruled that an African from Nigeria did not qualify for citizenship under the law of return, despite his claim that his 10 million member Igbo tribe, or Igbo tribe, descends from the tribe of Ephraim. Right? You Google Igbo, Nigeria, they talk about a large group of people who claim that they are Jewish living in Nigeria. The court claimed that they lacked any historical evidence of a Jewish community or of a continuous practice of Judaism predating the colonial contact. Now, as they're saying, it could be that after the Europeans came to Nigeria, so then some people, some of the locals, started adapting some Jewish customs, but it's not part of the Jewish Mesorah, the Jewish tradition. Of course, Ethiopians were deemed to be Jewish by the Israeli government. We will speak about the Ethiopians specifically. I think that's the next topic. But the issue of who is a Jew is an issue that is going on today. In January of this year, Ashkenazi Chief Rabbi of Israel, Rabbi Yitzchak Yosef, called for the law to be amended. According to a Jerusalem Post article, between 1989 and 2009, about 700,000, as I mentioned before, 700,000 of 1 million Russian Aleim were Jewish, but 30% were not, right? Some say it was 8 to 30. So this article said 30% of the Jews were not. This obviously relates to what the standards of conversion should be as well, which is another related topic. Since then, the proportion of non-Jewish immigrants from that region, according to this article, stood at 60%. Rav Aviner, Dean of Ateret Yerushalayim Yeshiva, also asserted that only halachic Jews should benefit from the law of return. Others still disagree and say that the law of return was designed as a refuge for Jews. So those who identify as Jews and anyone who is identified by the oppressors of Jews as Jewish should qualify. And what's fascinating is that it's not, I don't think it's correct to say that it's only Orthodox Jews who want to amend the law to limit who may be considered a Jew to perhaps the halachic definition because they're concerned about assimilation. But the truth is, many Israelis, many secular Israelis, do not think that there is a need for the state of Israel to accept additional immigrants. There is the whole notion of like, you know, we're a homeland for all Jews everywhere, we're all connected. So this, I think that we as Orthodox Jews feel very passionate about that. But your average Israeli, this is, you know, 70 years after the creation of the State of Israel, may not feel so passionate about viewing the Jewish state as being a state of kibbutz galios. So many Israelis do not feel connected with non-Israeli Jews. And we look at the Israel is the homeland, and we look about the history of Eretz Yisrael, bring the homeland and kibbutz galios, that's part of our theology as Orthodox Jews. But your average secular Israeli might not feel connected to the Jew who's living wherever. And so why should we, you know, maybe we don't even need a law of return. And maybe we should more narrowly define the law of return. Maybe having some of these immigrants coming, it hurts our, you know, the economics in Israel. Again, not to say we should have limitation on immigration, but there should not be automatic citizenship. I think it'll be interesting to see what the future holds for this law. I think that, and by the way, I just want to point out, it's much easier, I think, for the Israeli Supreme Court justice, the Israeli Supreme Court, to say that these people who claim that they're Jewish from Nigeria, that we're not going to allow however hundreds of thousands of people, millions of people, you know, to come in to our country if they assert that they're Jews. And because basically you don't have American, no one who supports Israel financially is really necessarily may not care that much. As opposed to, imagine if they would change the law to say that a Jew, for purpose of this law, is only someone who converts according to halacha. So then you're going to have all these non-Orthodox American Jews who will fight, very passionately against this. So, you know, this is a little bit of a political question of who's going to, what is Israel going to do for itself, and who they take into consideration to make their decisions. The question, are they going to want to basically alienate, further alienate potentially non-Orthodox American Jews? It will be interesting to see what the future holds for this law. Most Israelis do not view this law as discriminatory. This is a Jewish state. So there are certainly privileges for Jews in the state to ensure that they have a place to go where they can experience their Judaism without fear of oppression. Currently, there is a provision to keep families together in cases of intermarriage, which would allow some non-Jews who are spouses or children of Jews to be permitted to take advantage of this law. And again, I just raise the question for people to say, oh, it's a secular state, so we shouldn't follow the halachic definition of Judaism for who's a Jew. Even if we don't follow a halachic standard, we still need a secular definition. Is it anyone who identifies as a Jew? Right? We live in a world today where people can identify of self-identification, whether it's gender, so it could also be religion. So, people I am this because I define myself as this, therefore treat me as this. So maybe anyone who wants to come to Israel and say, I am Jewish, so I self-identify as Jewish. How do you determine, again, if you're not following the halachic definition, you still need some definition. What criteria should we require to determine that someone is a Jew? I think these are very tough questions. And again, the question is, should we seriously try to amend the law? Because by doing so, we'll likely cause major fighting, especially between Israel and the diaspora, if conversions from conservative reform are not allowed. Listen, the law of return has its problems. It's obviously very complicated. There's a lot of gray, and there's a lot of uneasiness in some of its details, and hopefully through this presentation, I've shared with you some of the gray, and I've shared with you some of the uneasiness. But I think the concept is beautiful, and I think this is an example, in my view at least, of the perfect is the enemy of the good. We Jews, this law of return stands for the position with all of its problems. We Jews are all connected, and every Jew has a home. That's such a beautiful concept. The law has a lot of challenges in practice, but I think it stands for the unity of Klal Yisrael and the unity of Klal Yisrael in Eretz Yisrael. And again, so we'll muddle along, we'll deal with the challenges, but I think the underlying principle and value, the underlying rationale, at least one of them, for which it was implemented, I think still is very strong even today. So that is my presentation.